but also represented detested British imperialist values.
If we're going to swear an oath of allegiance to anybody, it should be an oath of allegiance to the people, that elect us. We're all living in a democracy. We shouldn't be swearing an oath of allegiance, it seems to me, to a unelected monarchy.
150,000 COVID dead, 10 years of austerity, 120,000 of the most vulnerable and poor people dead. That's who I shed a tear from.
For now, the flag at the palace has been lowered, and on Monday, Parliament will honour the Duke with further tributes. But no matter how hard the establishment ignore it, the British royal legacy is tarnished. Robert Carter, London.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says Iran's demand is clear. It will only come back to full compliance with the agreement after the US lifts sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following the US withdrawal from the JCPOA. And Iran will also want to verify the sanctions lifting.
What we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the US to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
China's representative said the sides are narrowing down their differences. He said Beijing believes all the nuclear-related unilateral U.S. sanctions are illegal and should be lifted immediately to safeguard the JCPOA. The demand to lift all sanctions at once is a legitimate one, he said.
We think it's legitimate for them to lift it all at once, and it's an important issue.
But will they do it?
They have undertaken to do it. But we say that they must put it into action, turn their commitments into action.
Araghchi said he believes it is possible to get the job done sooner rather than later, but it depends on how willing and serious the other side is. After 3 days of intensive discussions within two working groups, the delegates agreed the talks are moving in the right direction. The Joint Commission will meet again on Wednesday amid hopes to maintain momentum. Homolesky, Vienna.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan, as he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns.
We aim to give a rest to our country during Ramadan and prepare it for better days after the Eid. If we could decrease the number of the cases to thousands, we will be able to catch the tourism season that is understood to be opened in May and the commercial activity that will be created by the tourism season.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases.
We expected to see a spread of the virus amid the third wave. However, we didn't expect to see such high numbers, especially after we began public vaccination. Turkish government's trying to create a balance between people's health and economy. That's why it's trying to implement measures to contain the spread of the virus until at least 60% of the country is vaccinated.
Turkey is pressing ahead with its nationwide vaccination campaign using the Sinovac and Pfizer-BioNTech's vaccine shots. So far, more than 10.55 million people have been given the first doses, and 7.41 million were given the second. Turkey's announcement of a nationwide lockdown during the holy month of Ramadan has created chaos, which is seen by many as the reason behind the increasing number of daily infections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Since Joe Biden took office in the U.S., relations between Washington and Moscow have only spiraled downwards. The Biden administration has signaled a more confrontational approach towards Russia. It has already hit Moscow with economic sanctions over the jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington has also threatened unspecified action over an alleged massive cyber attack, which it blames on Russia. Tensions have risen particularly after Biden publicly stated that he thinks Putin is a killer. Now, the Russian government says it will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions amid reports that the White House is about to announce further bans against Russia. This time, the source of tensions is the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Over the past 2 weeks, mainstream Western media outlets have been reporting about an increase in Russia's military presence along its borders with Ukraine. This coincides with reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russian media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic.
The
Israeli blockade in place over the past 14 years has battered the entire health system in the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and medical centers suffer from acute shortages in medicines and medical equipment, especially amid the rapid spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation.
On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Around 45% of Italian firms involved in productive sectors are structurally at risk. This is one of the major findings of a new report on the competitiveness of productive sectors in Italy, released by the Bureau of Statistics Istat on Wednesday. The report warns that firms operating mostly in sectors of low technological and knowledge content would not be able to survive to a further external crisis.
The situation wasn't very much different before the COVID crisis. Italian firms were already suffering from their usual weaknesses. If these firms don't receive financial aid in the coming 3 to 4 months, they will drown. Non-food activities are suffering the most.
A series of national lockdowns to safeguard Italy's population from COVID-19 and the collapse of the health system have resulted in an economic disaster. According to the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, about 390,000 businesses shut their doors in Italy last year.
The Istat report has found tourism, arts and entertainment, and catering are among the productive sectors that have suffered with great intensity from the impact of the containment measures adopted by the Italian authorities so far.
Take out food and delivery orders won't save my restaurant. That's all we've been allowed to do for months. Either we reopen in full or we die. We've got bills to pay.
I'm not surprised people have not yet taken to the streets to stage a revolution. I'm lucky to have my pension payments. Many, including my son, are jobless. Many went bankrupt.
Meanwhile, Italy has been swept by protests from north to south over the past days. Hospitality operators, restaurant owners, shopkeepers, street market traders are calling for reopenings as a second round of government economic support measures has been delayed. Max Civili, Rome.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a have marched on the United Nations office in the city to slam the international community's silence in the face of Saudi's illegal acts. The protesters called for international action amid the continued detention of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today we have completed 2 years of protests in front of the United Nations office. We organized 730 protests to denounce the continued piracy against fuel ships. We have a 1,400-meter-long letter of condemnation signed by the Yemenis. The United Nations and the U.S. are directly observing the detention of oil vessels, and they bear responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
The protesters slammed the U.S. as a key partner in exacerbating the suffering of millions of Yemenis. They said Saudi Arabia's U.S.-backed siege on Yemen has caused a severe shortage of basics, including fuel, food and water, leading to numerous deaths, including among children.
Public sector employees are protesting today in front of the United Nations office because the UN bears the moral and humanitarian responsibility regarding the continued detention of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition as it happens under the direct supervision of the UN.
Since the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade in Yemen, depriving millions of civilians of their necessities and even hampering the humanitarian aid in the war-torn country. This has pushed the country to the brink of famine and has wrecked the healthcare system.
For 2 years now, Yemenis have been protesting outside the United Nations office in Sana'a with no tangible results. However, they say their army is now capable of forcing Saudi Arabia into listening to their voices and lift the blockade it imposed on their country. Abdul Washali, Sana'a.
This racist, Islamophobic, misogynistic.
The daughter of a Muslim who was murdered by a white supremacist as he walked home from his local mosque has launched a campaign demanding the UK government finally adopt an Islamophobia definition. Maz Salim, whose father, Mohammed Salim, was killed by a neo-Nazi terrorist 8 years ago, has launched the campaign to highlight Islamophobic hate crimes and force the definition back on the government's agenda.
Pablo Lapkin was charged under terrorism law. It's been 8 years now. I've been tirelessly campaigning against racism and Islamophobia. And still today, my father's name is not being mentioned in the mainstream media as an act of terrorism. And I think that's really important because whenever a Muslim is a victim, the media is very biased in the way it reports it. It's always such as lone wolf or mosque bomber. Or murderer. No, he was actually, quite frankly, a terrorist. So I want that to be highlighted. That's extremely important.
The campaign includes an online hashtag, I am Mohammed Salim, which others can use to post testimonies exposing how dangerous Islamophobia is becoming.
I've already been inundated with a lot of videos, a lot of footage, which I'm going to release every single day. And if you already look on our Twitter and our Instagram, you can see already people speaking about their experience of racism, Islamophobia and xenophobia. So if you continue to send us these videos, then we can put pressure on the government as to what is exactly happening on our streets today.
Sadly, Mohammed Salim is not the only victim. In 2015, 81-year-old Mohsin Ahmed was killed by two men in a racially motivated attack in Rotherham. And in 2017, Makram Ali was killed during the Finsbury Park terror attack during the holy month of Ramadan. In 2018, an all-party parliamentary group issued a report on anti-Muslim prejudice, which urged the government to define Islamophobia. So far, the government has refused to do so. Islamophobic attacks and racist verbal abuse are becoming near normalised here in Britain, with many Muslims complaining that it's become basically a daily occurrence. But if the government continues to refuse to acknowledge that Islamophobia is a very real and vicious form of hate crime, then preventing future attacks and also providing justice to victims will continue to get all the more harder. Robert Carter, London.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. $715 billion is what U.S. President Joe Biden wants for the Pentagon out of the $753 billion he has requested for the 2022 fiscal year for military spending. Now, this is an increase over the Trump administration's expenditure on the American military. The U.S. already spends more on its military than the next 10 countries combined. Washington calls the department which deals with the military as the Defense Department, but it appears the U.S. is spending billions, not on actual defense, which would be at home or near home, but on total offense. The question is, why? Stay with me as we take a look at this and this debate. I'd like to welcome our correspondent out of Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, and our next guest out of Iowa, Brian Terrell, who is a peace activist and political commentator. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Colin, let's start off with you, and let's talk about his requests and what exactly it means.
Well, it means that he wants to raise the defense spending by about 2%. This is definitely more than the previous administration, at a time when many people believe there should be more money spent on domestic issues, such as education, such as health, especially amid a pandemic, many other issues that Americans are facing. But the Biden administration and the president believes that this defense spending is necessary in order to signal a message to China, which he believes is one of the nation's top adversaries when it comes to technology and defense. What this would do, though, if this budget were to pass, is to spend more on defense than the next 12 nations combined. It was previously 10, but I believe with this measure, this 2% increase, it would put that number at the next 12 nations combined. And he's raising some ire from some of his Democratic colleagues who are a little bit more left in the party. One of them, the head of the budget committee, and that would be Bernie Sanders, a former presidential candidate, who believes that this is a gross overstep in military spending. He believes that the administration should be looking at the adjustments and the overspending of the military in order to find those specific cuts and to save money. At the same time, however, we have to remember that we're dealing with a president who views himself as a little bit more of a centrist, or at least he wants to come across that way. And his Republicans on the other side of the aisle believe that with inflationary considerations in mind, this would be very stagnant as far as the proposal is concerned, meaning Republicans would like the president to propose more money for defense spending. So he has to walk this line in between those who are in his party, who are a little bit more left-leaning, who say that this is too much, and then those on the other side of the aisle who say that it's too little. And so he will need Republican support to pass this unless he's able to ram it through. But of course, there are those who believe that within the Democratic Party, this could be very divisive when looking at the amount of money that's being spent and what it's being spent on.
All right. Thanks so much, Colin. Let me cross over to Brian. Brian, Biden ran on the campaign of ending forever wars. What do you think that he meant by that? And do you think that Washington really wants to end its wars, for example, in Iraq and Afghanistan during this current administration?
I'm afraid not. I think we're seeing a different rhetoric now, but not much difference. In fact, as really we're an increase in spending. The United States, as Joe Biden said, if we don't get going, China is going to eat our lunch. But at present, the United States has 800 bases outside the United States in 70 different countries. China has one base in Djibouti outside of its borders. The provocations are coming from the United States. It's not China that's having military exercises in the ocean off its waters. It's the United States that with South Korea is having exercises within in the South China Sea. So this is really, as we're seeing with the war in Yemen and Afghanistan, is the Biden administration wants to talk differently about this. But we are a country that has one of our major exports now is weapons being sent to other countries, not to mention the weapons produced for ourselves.
Right.
And we don't produce anything. We don't make our shoes, we don't make our ballpoint pens, all the stuff comes from China. And it's because we have a wartime economy that we're dependent on this. And if war spending stopped or slowed down or even decreased or even stopped increasing at the levels that even Biden's approving, our economy is really going to suffer become just dependent on war.
Stay with me, Brian. Let me introduce our next guest, Ian Williams, Senior Analyst Foreign Policy in Focus out of New York. Ian, good to have you with us. In your perspective, does the U.S. want to become even more militaristic? And is this the reason Biden wants to increase the Pentagon's budget even more? Or exactly why would this country need to spend even more money than, as our correspondent said, the next 12 nations combined?
I think there's a whole complex of reasons, and some of them are built into the country's infrastructure, political infrastructure. Lobbying always works. So you have huge lobbies that want to build weapons because they make money out of building weapons. You have progressive people who say, we don't really want to build weapons as a principle, but you make sure that aircraft carrier is built in my district. It's sort of Keynes by cannon. You know, they're pumping money into the local economies with weapons because, as your previous guest pointed out, the U.S. has stopped making things that people want to buy mostly, except for the weapons. And, you know, then, you know, there is a strategic look at China is not totally innocent. China is aggressively building up its arms, not nearly on the same scale. It's not nearly the total bad guy, but it has been building up weapons in particular areas. And, you know, if it wanted to persuade the U.S. to disarm, all China would have to do would be to say, we pledge not to attempt to take Taiwan by military means. And that would end it. It would remove half the excuses for the lobby who want to send more aircraft carriers to the Pacific, who to build more ships and planes and missiles.
Don't you think, Ian, that then there would be another excuse? I mean, we've had so many examples of actually countries saying, I'll use the one that I'm sitting in right now, Iran, and of course the whole excuse they wanted to exert military pressure, economic pressure, because of allegedly Iran and the bomb. And of course, Iran has said time and time again, and it's been proven that it has a peaceful nuclear program, but still the aggression continues. So you said if China would say that, then the U.S. would stop. But isn't it always after excuses, basically?
It's a complex process because, I mean, since you mentioned Iran, the Pentagon spent $20 billion or something like that on the literal ships that apparently don't work, but they were designed to deal with Iran because they worked out that you can have a huge lumbering aircraft carrier and a Revolutionary Guard in a motorboat with a Olympic mine could sink it. You know, it's the disproportionate of forces here. So, you know, they're thinking of all sorts of wars, but one of the big problems is you've even got inter-service competition there. There are people racing to build bigger and fancier weapons that look more spectacular, but are often very ineffective. For years, the U.S.'s best weapon was the Warthog, a close support aircraft for troops, which is what they were supposed to be for, and the Air Force didn't want that. The Air Force wanted super hypersonic Mach stealth craft that would fly in the space and do Star Wars stuff that nobody wanted, that there wasn't such a battle. There were battles on the ground, which they could have fought, so, you know, apart from the geopolitics, it's really bad planning. They've got themselves bogged down.
Okay.
They got
competitive. Let me get Brian back in on this discussion. Brian, your take on this increased military spending keeps the hegemon at the time more and more in power. At least that's what it thinks, that it has to, it feels that it has to spend this much money. It's in the process of bullying other countries. If other countries do not listen to its demands, then it threatens it with military or even economic tactics. Is that what it's all about when we see this continual increase in military spending?
Yes, I think this is what President Eisenhower warned about when he left office in the 1950s, a military-industrial complex that that the United States is so dependent on economically on war that we're manufacturing wars so that we can sell weapons and not manufacturing weapons to fight wars. And I don't believe it has a lot to do with the geopolitics. I think you're right that if it weren't China, it would be Iran or be Russia or be Cuba or be Nicaragua of all things, that we have these fears that the fears are being stoked to the American people that there's somebody out there out for us and that we need to, our response has to be overwhelming military force. And of course we can, there's, you know, the threat to the United States now is really, it's a nuclear war that could destroy everything. And that's part of the budget we're not talking about, because $50 billion also is going not to the Pentagon, mm-hmm. but to the Department of Energy to for the production, research and production of new nuclear weapons. The United States is on a huge program of developing new nuclear weapons at a time when it really ought to be disarming, weapons that we simply don't need. And at a time when we have, as you mentioned, the COVID epidemic, not only here but around the world, there are whole countries that have not had any COVID vaccinations at all. And the security of the United States is much more dependent on having those vaccines get to places like Haiti and Iraq and Afghanistan than having our aircraft carriers and bombers. But we're not spending on that.
Okay. Well, Ian, despite spending so much money over the years, why is it that the United States has really not won a war since World War II? What does it mean?
Well, that when they spend the money, they're spending it without too much regard for who the enemy is going to be. This huge amount of military spending was fighting the old Cold War, was fighting a huge land war in Europe, which never happened. The low-intensity wars that they've been fighting, the weaponry was huge, impressive, and pretty much ineffective, it can be. But, you know, everyone's looking at examples. You know, wars are serious business. People get killed. But nobody's really drawing these lessons. You know, you've got different procurement departments of the Pentagon. You've got the Air Force, the Marines, you've got the Navy, you've got the Army, all with their own wish lists. And it's part of the great American tradition. The officers who direct these procurement departments are on a revolving door. Within 6 months of them retiring on a huge pension, they then go and work for the very companies to which they were selling, that they were buying from a few weeks before. It's a completely closed web of what's really corruption. Of swapping personnel. And then you've got Congress, where people who want to stay in Congress have to raise thousands of dollars a day just for their campaign expenses. So they go, like the guy who robbed banks, he went to banks because that's where the money was. These people go to the pharmaceutical companies to keep drugs protected. They go to military defense complexes because they're the ones with huge money. The ones who make the aircraft and the missiles, they are the big lobbyists. They, and not just them, but their constituents as well, the people who work for them in the shipyards and in the factories, they'll go and lobby. So everybody is busily doing the sort of Adam Smith thing, the invisible hand, but the hands are very visible and they're always filled with greenbacks poking towards congressmen's buckets.
Okay, well, Brian, you heard Ian, and he was talking about as far as different types of lobbyists and as far as producing manufacturing various military equipment, but it appears that you pointed out earlier that the main production or manufacturing now that's being done in the U.S. is the manufacturing of weapons and other military equipment. I mean, why couldn't lobbyists or others or various states concentrate on other type of manufacturing, which at one point in time the U.S. was known for?
Because that's where the investments are. You know, when President Biden a few weeks ago spoke about stopping the support for the Saudi war in Yemen, the CEO of Raytheon, one of the biggest war profiteers, told his stockholders, don't worry, peace is not going to break out anytime soon, and the Middle East is going to continue to be an area of growth for us. So this is, it's one of the terrible things that you ask the question about these wars that aren't won. And I'm afraid that they're not intended to be won. They're intended to be maintained. They're intended to be permanent. Or else if one fades out just for out of exhaustion, another one gets picked up immediately after, because there's such incentive to keep these wars going. And one of the horrible things about this too is that the Department of Defense of the United States has been rated one of the number one users of fossil fuel and producers of greenhouse emissions. At a time when all this technology and all this money, we don't have any problems, I don't believe, that cannot be solved. But we're not going to solve any of the world's problems, any of the United States' problems, and more than $715 billion is going to the military. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be a healthy society. We're not going to educate our children. We're not going to have usable infrastructure. We're on a downward spiral, and a few people are getting richer and richer. But this has to stop.
Well, Ian, based on what Ryan just said, I want your take too. I mean, your take on all this, because why does Washington continue to bait other countries into military conflicts, such as what is going on right now with China? American ships are in the South China Sea. I mean, does it want war when it hasn't been very successful in winning wars? Now, Brian said basically the goal is just to keep the wars going. Do you agree with that, or what exactly is going on here?
Look, if you're going to be a cynic, you could describe the Cold War as the greatest economic expansion plan in human history. They managed to get all of the expansionary facts that you get from a real war without the destruction on themselves that it entails. They've taxed people, they've pumped huge amounts of money into the economy, and until Reagan came along and stopped workers getting proper rises, it actually benefited lots of people. People were thinking back then to the 30s and hunger and when factories were idle. Factories weren't idle because they were busy making helicopters and planes and rockets. And it kept everybody busy. It meant that people were going. This time, there's a mentality. It comes again. Not only are the lobbyists always right, but the defense lobby. There hasn't been a defense budget that's been turned down by either side. It's increased every single year. And you have to put this in the context of this is a society where you can rally the voters and the congressmen against spending on a single-payer healthcare system. Because that's obviously outrageous. It would actually be much cheaper. But no, that's unthinkable. But any addition to the defense budget is patriotic, and any attempt to diminish the budget or stop the budget expanding is a patriotic sellout to the unspecified enemy, whoever it is, that everybody falls for. So you have this perfect political machine for delivering money to the arms manufacturers. The problem is sometimes it does spill over into a war, and then they're not very good at it, as mm-hmm. we've seen.
Okay.
The Middle East is filled with America's failed wars, Vietnam. And I think a lot of Americans think that they won the Vietnam War because it's been wiped out of history, in a sense. They think they won the Iraq War when they're about to leave with their tail between their legs.
Okay, let me get Brian back in. Sorry, Ian, I'm just about out of time. But Brian, I mean, according to the Social Progress Index, which ranks countries by the quality of life, the U.S. is rated 28. Now, why would a country, which is supposed to be number one, the superpower in the world, but deteriorating rapidly, not concentrate more on its citizens and their overall quality of life instead of focusing so much on these bombs and nukes and other military equipment? And why, in your perspective, has the American people not risen up against this?
Oh, that last question, that really strikes to the heart. And I wish I knew why, because rising up against this has been my life goal for 40 years. Just found little pockets of it here and there that are encouraging, but there needs to be there really needs to be a revolutionary change here, and I think the kind of changes that we need to make are just that revolutionary. We've seen the disappointment now in that many people have in the Biden administration, who are hoping that they'd see a turnaround, when really the choice is how much is the military budget going to increase? How much are we going to rob the treasury of the people all the more to feed the military-industrial weapons complex? It's not a matter of whether we're going to do that or not. We don't have the our political mechanisms don't allow us.
Okay.
The power of the lobbyists. We don't have anything against that now. So.
Right, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. We're out of time. Peace activist and political commentator Brian Terrell out of Iowa and senior analyst foreign policy in focus, Ian Williams out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on this debate. I'm Marzi Hashmi. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
A new report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, reveals that one of the major gases behind climate change has reached its highest level in 3.6 million years. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Matteo Rosa Ryder. This article is published under the heading Carbon Dioxide Levels Reach 3.6 Million Year High. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Because the COVID-19 pandemic caused a massive economic slowdown, experts had hoped that the decline in transportation and manufacturing might slow greenhouse gas emissions at least a little. Unfortunately, a new report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, reveals that one of the major gases behind climate change has reached its highest level in 3.6 million years. The NOAA reports that the average amount of carbon dioxide, CO2, in the atmosphere was 412.5 parts per million in 2020, an increase by 2.6 ppm through the course of the year. Climate scientists generally agree that, in order for life on Earth to be minimally interrupted, Earth's carbon dioxide levels should remain under 350 parts per million. Yet since NOAA began recording atmospheric composition data in 1960, there has not been a year in which carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere did not increase. Likewise, in 2020, overall carbon dioxide emissions increased at the fifth highest rate in the 63 years that NOAA has been recording. It was only surpassed by the rates of increase in 1987, 1998, 2015, and 2016. A senior scientist at NOAA's Global Monitoring Lab, Peter Tense, said that if there had not been an economic slowdown, it would have been the highest increase on record. At things current stand, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are at a point comparable to the mid-Paleocene warm period, when the temperature was 7 degrees hotter and the sea level was roughly 78 feet higher than today. Another organization, Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, released similar results, announcing that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was 417.4 ppm at their monitoring station in Hawaii. The NOAA also reported a significant jump in the atmospheric burden of methane in 2020, with the annual amount increasing by 14.7 parts per billion in 2020. Not only is this the biggest jump since methane levels began to be systematically measured in 1983, but it is also troubling because of how effective methane is at trapping heat. Although there is much less methane than carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it is 28 times more potent at trapping heat over the course of a century. Still, the COVID-19 lockdowns had a minor effect on emissions. The estimates vary among the different groups doing these sorts of calculations, but the consensus seems to be about a 7% decrease in greenhouse gas emissions relative to 2019 levels. Dr. Michael E. Mann, a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University, wrote to reporters in December. If climate change is not halted and or reversed in the near future, experts agree that there will be serious and negative repercussions for all life on Earth, including humans. There will be an increase in extreme weather events like hurricanes and blizzards, an increase in the amount of wildfires, and a reduction in the amount of land that can be used to produce food. All of this will lead to fierce competition for resources and mass population displacements, even as an increasing amount of the world's surface either too hot or too dry to be inhabitable. President Joe Biden has said that he will prioritize fighting climate change in his presidency. Shortly after taking office, he said in a statement that environmental justice will be at the center of all we do. We'll be right back.
Beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up,